provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. With them or without them. In recent months and weeks, there was reportedly considerable debate inside the Bush administration about the merits of working with the United Nations. The hawks said, forget about them, go it alone. Senior Republican statesmen went public with their doubts, and the balance tipped the other way. 2 weeks ago, Bush, the son of a UN diplomat himself, went to New York and stood in front of the green marble backdrop of the UN General Assembly.
The conduct of the Iraqi regime is a threat to the authority of the United Nations and a threat to peace. Iraq has answered a decade of UN demands with a decade of defiance. All the world now faces a test, and the United Nations a difficult and defining moment. Are Security Council resolutions to be honored and enforced, or cast aside without consequence? Will the United Nations serve the purpose of its founding, or will it be irrelevant?
Now, there's a challenge. Questioning the relevancy of the UN is hardly a throwaway line in any speech, but it also complicates Bush's options. Connection listeners, the president has challenged the UN to deliver a tough and uncompromising resolution he says is required. So what if, after all the diplomatic massaging and arm-twisting, the resolution does not meet the expectations of the White House? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. With us on the program today at the NPR studio in New York is Nancy Soderbergh. She's former U.S. Deputy Ambassador at the UN Security Council, and she's currently Vice President of the International Crisis Group in New York. Here in the studio with me, Elizabeth Newfer. She's a reporter for the Boston Globe who's been covering the United Nations. She's also author of The Key to My Neighbor's House. It's a book about UN war crimes tribunals. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Good morning.
Elizabeth, let me start with you. What's the latest that we know about this little piece of paper that has now traveled God knows how many times around the globe, having people scratch their own little notions on it about whether or not there will be all means necessary, appropriate for, I mean, what do we know about where that is now?
Well, it's still being discussed out in capitals because, of course, the key thing is that the U.S. has to get France and Russia on board. They're both veto-wielding members of the Council and can stop a resolution like that absolutely in its tracks. The key elements of the resolution basically give Saddam Hussein 7 days to say, yes, I'm going to comply with this resolution.
Seven days from the moment of the passage of the resolution, is
right,
that right?
Okay. Right. And then the remainder of a month to basically declare all materials relating to weapons of mass destruction, open up his presidential palaces, and let weapons inspectors in.
And the suggestion that there be some sanction attached to that resolution, that the UN will allow all necessary or appropriate necessary means is the phrase. Thank you.
And it actually is lifted out of an earlier resolution, which is, I think, was an effort to try and make this more palatable, because that means, of course, countries have agreed to this language before.
Nancy, is there something to that, that if the drafters can mark, cut, and paste together phrases and ideas from earlier resolutions, that it might pass more easily?
Absolutely. The key to anyone trying to negotiate a Security Council resolution is to draw on language that's already been approved. It's very hard for countries to say, no, I can't agree to that now when they did earlier. I think the tough part in the negotiations on this will be the timetable, the very tight timetable that the Bush administration wants. And I think that that's what they're arguing about right now in capitals, the all necessary means piece. It's hard for people to vote against. The French would like two separate resolutions. They don't want to pre-authorize war. They want to be involved in the judgment of whether or not the Iraqis have met the new conditions, not just leave it up to the Bush administration to start
But is the debate,
if they determine it.
Sorry, is the debate, though, Nancy, over whether there should be a timetable or not, or just how long it should be? Because my understanding of the timetable is that, unlike previous UN Security Council resolutions, this at least says if you don't do it by that time, then the or else happens.
Well, it's both. The French would like to have a they're okay on a timetable, but they want to come back to the council to determine what action the council should take. Others don't want any timetable. The Russians in particular would prefer not to have any timetable. My guess is they will get something of a timetable, but not the tight timetable that the British and the U.S. are currently shopping. That's what's going on in capitals over the weekend and over the next few days. It will not come back to New York until those discussions have progressed further than they have right now.
Is that the way it's normally done, Nancy, that the wording goes to all the different capitals? And so really, by the time it shows up at the U.N. Security Council, everybody knows how everybody's going to vote.
Pretty much so. I mean, on the smaller resolutions, the ambassadors at the United Nations have a fair amount of leeway to negotiate it on their own. But on any of the big ones, the real decisions are made in capitals. And you've got, when I was at the council, we were always calling Washington to try and get the Secretary of State or the National Security Advisor on the phone with someone in France or the UK or Russia because we couldn't get anywhere in New York. So that's fairly standard. It obviously complicates the process and draws it out, but it means that whatever agreement you get is much more likely to stick.
And Elizabeth, you made reference at the beginning to the veto-wielding members, the five original nuclear powers who have the opportunity to say no to any UN Security Council. We never seem to talk about the other 10 people who sit around the table at the UN Security Council. Is it because at the end of the day, they don't matter that much?
Well, they do matter. They are called, in common parlance, the elected 10, the E10, because they sit on the council for 2 years. And, of course, who is on the council is very important. I mean, certainly the administration is keeping an eye on the fact that the Germans will be sitting on the council come January, which certainly on the question of Iraq will complicate things immensely for them.
I mean, they won't have a veto, but they will carry more weight than a Cameroon or a Mauritius at that point?
No. They're going to have exactly the same status, but just simply because of their stance on the war.
Right.
But of course, the other members play a key role because you want to get this passed with full unanimous approval. You have to win over the E10. But because they can't block a vote, they're considered slightly less important. But they're very important nonetheless.
And Nancy, when you take a look at the people who are there, for example, Syria comes to mind as perhaps the most likely of the 15 to say no to something like this. Are there others? Do the elected 10 make a difference this time around?
I would say they do on the margins. The truth is, once you get the P5, is the permanent five, on board, the rest will follow. The numbers are such that as long as you have 9 affirmative votes in the council, a resolution passes. So even if Assyria votes against it, it will still pass. You've got Mexico, Colombia. I think they'll probably go along with this. Cameroon, Guinea will probably go along. Ireland. I don't see any real block of countries that would vote against it. They certainly don't have the 6 or 7 needed to actually block passage of this. And it's also for the optics of it. I mean, the U.S. here and the British have already begun meeting with them to explain the draft, talk to them about it, talk them through, so you don't have a backlash as if they're just kind of window dressing here. But the real action is with the permanent five members. And the Chinese will more or less follow the Russians. So it's really in Moscow and Paris that this is going to be decided.
I wonder if you can both help us with a kind of a broader look at what this is going to mean for Bush, because so much of our attention so far has focused on what's the wording going to be, who will support it. If the resolution goes through in a form that, it's not really what the White House wanted, but it's close. Has Bush put himself in a position, Elizabeth, maybe you can start on this, has Bush put himself in a position where he's sort of obliged to take it because he made the decision to go to New York?
Well, I mean, obviously, a Security Council resolution, once it's passed, is binding. It's international law. So, he will have to follow the terms of that resolution just as Iraq would have to. So, yes, the advantage he has is that he has sought both moral and practical approval from a world body, 191-member world body, which is a very different scenario than going it alone.
Nancy?
This is all about politics and optics. He has adequate authority under the 1991 resolutions passed at the end of the Gulf War to take all necessary means to enforce those resolutions. People forget that we're doing that right now, that our planes, along with the UK planes, are flying almost weekly bombing missions over Iraq and have for the last 7 years. We regularly are taking out those sites that are threatening our aircraft, so-called painting them with radar, which is the action you take before you're about to fire something, and have escalated those attacks greatly. Now, the Russians have long opposed those so-called no-fly zones that we're enforcing, but we interpret it differently and take action. The real reason President Bush decided to go forward to the United Nations is to try and get a strong international backing for what he's doing, not only for the war, but also for the cleanup, which is going to be very costly, and we'd like to be able to share the cost of rebuilding and reconstructing Iraq with others.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is if the resolution that everyone at the Security Council is looking at is less than the forceful document that Bush wanted. Is it the U.S. option at that point to say, you know what, we're just not going to vote for it? You know,
but I think having taken it this far, they're likely to get pretty close to what they need. And if it's a little weaker than they want, they'll put the best face on it, claim victory, and go ahead and do what they were going to do anyway.
Yeah, I agree with Nancy. She also makes an excellent point, which we should remember that, after all, this is a ceasefire with Iraq when you go back to 1990. So that does give Bush some wiggle room if this whole thing falls apart down the road.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Northampton, Massachusetts. Brian's on the line. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how's it going?
Fine, thanks.
So I think that regardless of what Iraq does, in Bush's mind, this thing is going to fall apart. As long as there's oil in them Nar Hills, he's going to make sure that that everything does fall apart. I think that this has little to do with weapons of mass destruction, and it has everything to do with the resource of mass consumption. And Bush wants his fingers on it. And this resolution,
keep us at the UN, if you would, Brian, in terms of whether or not what is happening in New York this week, next week, is going to make a difference.
The UN is a formality, basically. Bush is going to the UN to appease people who are critical of his policy. And he has this agenda planned out. He knows exactly what he's going to do. I'd like to know exactly what the process is for the resolution. How is the resolution is developed, it goes out to the world, it comes back, then what happens?
Elizabeth, can you do that in under 30 seconds?
There's going to be a lot of arm twisting at the council, basically. They're going to go, first there will be a meeting of the P5, the permanent five. They'll get a draft. They'll officially sort of sign off on it. The draft will then probably go to the E10. And the idea will be to line up votes. They'll call for a vote. They'll meet.
Does this happen in public at any point? Is there television coverage of what's going on in that Security Council room?
It depends. It can have public or private sessions. Nancy might be better on the protocol.
Nancy, what do you think is going to happen on this one?
This will all be done behind closed doors. It'll be done in capitals initially. They'll bring it back to New York once they have agreement. The U.S. and the U.K. will meet individually or collectively with the other members of the council to bring them on board. And then they'll take it into what's called the informal chamber off the side of that famous room where everyone has seen on television to work it out. And only once there's agreement on how people will vote will they take it into the public chamber.
All right, Brian, thanks very much for your call. Connection listeners, Brian says it's just a formality. It doesn't really matter what happens in that inside chamber. Well, we'll stay in the inside chamber for the balance of the hour to get a better sense of what exactly is going to happen in New York and what difference it will make for future policy decisions of the Bush administration. We're at 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Public Radio.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, a conversation about what's happening, what's going to happen at the United Nations, and what the implications of that decision will be for the Bush administration. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio here in Boston, Elizabeth Newfer. She's a reporter for the Boston Globe. She covers the UN. She's also author of a book called The Key to My Neighbor's House. And joining us from the NPR studio in New York, Nancy Soderberg, former U.S. Deputy Ambassador at the UN Security Council. She's currently Vice President of the International Crisis Group in New York. Sounds like those jobs kind of fit well together, Nancy. Is that right?
They're great. It was wonderful.
One's an international crisis group that's called that. One's an international crisis group that's called something else. Can you just
one you have a lot of power and a veto. The other one, you just have moral authority.
Take us, if you can, to that informal chamber that you were describing where the business of the Security Council really takes place before you go into public sessions. Do the five sit around and talk amongst themselves and then bring the elected 10 in? Or can someone at the elected 10 act as a power broker or a messenger from group to group? I mean, give us a sense of the dynamics.
It's really all of the above. It's one of the most fascinating processes to watch. And there's all sorts of coalitions and groups that are in, groups that are out. The Security Council has a rotating membership, so this changes every year. You have a different mix. But what you really have is a constant dynamic of sort of resentment of the elected 10 over the permanent 5, because everyone knows that the cool kids on the block are the permanent 5, and no matter what the others try to do, they're never quite in the crowd. And that creates a dynamic and a tension that's quite interesting. And then you also have the Russians often forming alliances with countries that are traditionally opposing the America's agenda. And so you have that dynamic going on. The worst sort of dynamics I've ever seen is in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where we would be in the council till 2 in the morning with emotions running high in the Palestinians and Israelis in the corridors and people trying to align up basically against Israel in the council. And people get very personal and heated arguments way into the night. It's one of the most interesting dynamics. It's unfortunate that more of it isn't in public, because by the time it gets into the formal chamber, it's kind of stiff and boring. But that back room is one of the most interesting areas to watch the sausage in the making.
There is, sounds like a great wide gap between those resolutions, such as the Middle East resolutions you referred to, which seem to pop up at 24 hours notice, and then ones like we're talking about this one, where everybody's watching it, and it may be a sausage that takes a month to make and reams of newspaper copy tracking it.
Well, I was talking to some folks this morning about what they thought the timing was, and I said, a week, 2 weeks, a month. I mean, they're all predicting a fairly short timetable. I personally think it's going to take a little longer than the U.S. and the U.K. hope, because it'll take them a while to get agreement among the P5, and the Russian and the French are not on board yet. People are putting a good face on it, but they're not at yes yet. And then you'll have a series of talking to the others to try and get them on board, probably a few minor changes in language to make them happy, to try and go for that 15 yes votes. I think, as you pointed out earlier, it's going to be a tough sell to get Syria on board. But frankly, if Syria votes no, it still will pass, and that can be viewed as still a victory.
You made reference to the two veto-wielding members to watch, Russia and France. We have on the line with us Dominique Moisy. He's deputy director of the French Institute of International Relations. Hi, Dominique.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. I'm interested in the latest perspective from Paris on this, whether or not the French objections are being specifically or substantively addressed by American or British diplomats. What's your sense of what's happening?
Not yet. I think we are still expressing our strong reservation. And, this is what the diplomatic process is about. We want to be convinced by the Americans, and the Americans have to show that they have convinced other partners, which are reluctant. By the end, I suppose, if the Americans are successful, I don't think the French will like to appear as the only veto power in the Big Five, and they will probably give a yes, but we are far from it yet. I think what the previous speaker has said is absolutely in line with reality, the way one sees it from Paris.
Now, you said the French diplomats are yet to be convinced. Convinced of what? Because one of the things that I've read in a story that Elizabeth wrote here in Boston is that one of the main objections in France is that the people there, the diplomats there, don't actually believe that the resolution is about getting weapons inspectors back in, but the resolution is about creating impossible conditions for Saddam Hussein and, in effect, paving the way to an attack. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I think let's try to understand. I mean, from the American perspective, the goal is to get rid of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of Saddam Hussein. But in order to make sure that that goal is really going to be reached, you need a change of regime, because this is the only guarantee by the end of the day that those weapons will not be used or will not be continued in their research. From the French perspective, and I don't think we are alone in that category, there is a resentment at the fact that the Americans seems to consider that war is the first solution and not the solution of last resort. And from that point of view, we may understand the American logic, but we tend to say, well, you can't go at it that way because you have not calculated the political consequences, and you don't have the understanding of the complexities of the region. You were not a colonial power in the sense we were in the past, and you do not put yourself in the emotional place of the Arab Street, something like that.
Elizabeth, how's that argument being heard by the Americans in New York?
Well, I think that, you know, Dominique makes a really excellent point, which is what's going to happen with the cleanup. Typically, when a country, we see regime change or we see a war in a country, we see a massive change, when it's done under the UN hubris, it's often the UN that goes in to help orchestrate a new government get in charge. I think the point that Dominic raised is that there doesn't seem to be any kind of thought about, once we get rid of Saddam Hussein, who's next and who helps rebuild this country? Who helps bring these various warring ethnic groups that are there together into one unified state?
Dominic, one more for you. The other sort of sub-paragraph that comes up with the French objections is that really this is all about money. This is about oil contracts. This is about weapons contracts between the French and the Iraqis, between the Russians and the Iraqis. Is there something to that as well?
Well, I'm sure there is in France a large segment of public opinion convinced that it is all about oil, it is all about contract, whatever. But I think the position of the French government has drastically changed. I mean, yesterday there was in Le Monde, the first leading French newspaper, an article by the French foreign minister stating very clearly that the threat of Saddam Hussein was real, that in fact the world would be a much safer place without Saddam Hussein, but that at the same time you could not accept the purely militaristic approach of the Americans, that you had to consider what would happen the day after, and that we had to try to look for other solution, and that the ball was in Saddam Hussein's camp for a few more weeks.
Dominic, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Dominic Moisy, Deputy Director of the French Institute of International Relations. And Nancy, when I listen to Dominic quoting from Le Monde there, I'm thinking to myself, it sounds a bit like a shift. It sounds a bit like, you know, the French, having made their principled stand against it, are also now finding the language that allows them to move to a position where they support a resolution.
One of the dirty little secrets of the Iraq dynamics at the Security Council, it is largely driven by money from Moscow and Paris. If you just look at the billions of dollars at stake here, Russia has over $8 billion in debt owed it by Iraq from weapons it sold it during the war with Iran a decade ago. It's got $40 to $60 billion in potential contracts in the oil and transport sector. It's its largest trader. France is second, right behind them. Both of these capitals have serious money on the table and an interest in continuing those ties with Saddam Hussein. And what you saw over the last decade is a deterioration in the 1991 post-Gulf War scenario in the Council, where there was unity on demanding compliance by Saddam Hussein. That eroded over the last decade, primarily in Moscow and in Paris, and China kind of falling in behind Russia, as these capitals started cutting deals worth tens of billions of dollars. And while they would call for a lifting of the sanctions and crying crocodile tears over the humanitarian crisis caused primarily by Saddam Hussein, not the sanctions, the consensus in the Council deteriorated, and that's why we're in the mess that we're in today.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. And to Greensboro, North Carolina, Bob's joining us. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how you doing? In reference to the Bush going to the Security Council for the resolution, you know, it's common sense, if anyone with common sense would think about this, that we already have the power to go into Iraq and enforce the resolutions that have already been passed. And, you know, it's just amazing to me that everyone says we need to go there. I know that our president is doing it to appease, you know, critics from all throughout the world. But, I mean, and some folks say, well, we pulled our inspectors out. Yes, we did. But we pulled them out because they were not being allowed to go where they needed to go to check on these weapons of mass destruction. And people saying that there are ulterior motives there, I mean, you can make an ulterior motive out of anything if you want to dream it up and politicize things.
Bob, let me just pick up the first point that you raised, Elizabeth.
Sure.
Bob saying that Bush had no reason to go to the UN, that legally, I think I'm characterizing what you're saying here, Bob, accurately, legally, the resolutions were all there.
Yes.
Was it just all about appeasement then?
No, I don't think it was, actually. I mean, Bob makes a good point, which is, in fact, there we do have the right to enforce existing resolutions. But the problem is the existing resolutions do allow a lot of wiggle room. And what the administration is trying to do at the moment is to get a much tougher, tougher resolution passed that will make it all but impossible for Saddam Hussein to kind of let things get bypassed. One point of correction, actually, the UN weapons inspectors were pulled out in advance of a U.S.-British military strike to make Saddam Hussein comply. And not just because, I mean, you're right that they were having a hard time getting access to things. The whole point of this new resolution would be to really say, look, we're serious. You know, here's what you've got to do. And if you're not serious, you know, all necessary means.
Yeah, I completely support the president going to the Security Council and what he did. I'm just trying to say that his critics, I don't see where they have a leg to stand on in criticizing him, you know, or you know, even this guy that called earlier saying it's all about oil. I mean, if they can't see the writing on the wall that we have a threat, the key being Security Council and our national security to protect our citizens. You know, and those people are going to be the very ones, if we have another terrorist action or a bomb goes off in the United States, they're going to be the ones that says and has the president's cabinet and court saying, why didn't you do anything to stop this,
Bob,
like they are doing now?
Let me ask you a question. If the UN Security Council comes up with a resolution that doesn't work, or if, you know, if that effort falls apart, do you have any reservations about the president, in effect, saying, OK, we're on our own now?
No, I don't, because, you know, if Iraq will not let us in to check out these locations that are possibly manufacturing chemical gases or nuclear, you know, it's our responsibility to the people of this nation and actually of the world to go in there and take them out. I'm not for war. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I've seen war firsthand. I do not want our young people going over there and dying, but they're all volunteers. They believe in what they're doing. If I was young enough, I would go. You know, it's a matter of national security. Our children, my 13-year-old daughter, my wife, you know.
Bob, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Appreciate hearing from you. 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. To Wisconsin, Oshkosh, and Mark's on the line. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. My take on this whole thing is that it seems utterly disingenuous to the Bush administration. If you paid any attention at all, from the very inception of his administration, he's done everything in his power to destabilize the United Nations.
You don't think there was a shift halfway through the first 2 years, September 11th, you don't think that there's any opinion?
Before September 11th, he was doing everything in his power to destabilize the United Nations and going on his own. After September 11th, he made what few alliances he needed to go over to Afghanistan, and once that was taken care of, he went back to destabilizing the United Nations. I mean, if you stop and think historically, what we're seeing now is not unlike what happened with the League of Nations and the Third Reich prior to World War II. And to me, that is an incredibly frightening thing. Here we have a president who was anointed by five judges, who has put out executive orders that are limiting our freedoms and forced Congress to pass laws, the Patriot Act, et cetera, that are limiting our constitutional freedoms.
Let me just stay with
fascism. Let's face it,
Mark. Let's stay with the UN for the purposes of the conversation, Nancy. The way that Bush is relating to the international organization, is it seen by people there as crafty or clumsy?
Generally, it's viewed here with shock and horror. It's in some cases been so bad that people just shake their heads in disbelief. So I would have to agree that with the caller that the general approach to the Bush administration has been undermining the UN, the Kyoto Treaty. That there have been vetoing peacekeeping resolutions in the Balkans and elsewhere over the International Criminal Court. They've had representatives giving the equivalent of the NRA speech to the General Assembly, and you know, things, you know, repeatedly over the top that just are gratuitous and unnecessary and undermining it. What happens, though, is reality has seeped in repeatedly in the Bush administration. They, you know, if you look at the people who are around President Bush, none of them have any experience in the new tough era. Condi Rice was at the National Security Council as the expert on a country that no longer exists, the Soviet Union. She's got 2 years of experience in government, has never really had to deal with some of these very tricky issues. Rumsfeld has not been in government since the 70s. Cheney's was Secretary of Defense, but not sort of in the post-Cold War era where we're dealing with these messy problems. So they actually believed their campaign rhetoric, but when they actually get into power, power is sobering, and September 11th forced them to realize that they need the rest of the world to carry out their business. So they're working to change their position and expand the peacekeeping mission in Afghanistan.
We have to take a break, so let me interrupt you there. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
Support for National Public.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the way that the Bush team takes its tactics to the United Nations at present. With me in the studio, Elizabeth Neufer. She works for the Boston Globe covering the UN. She's author of a book called The Key to My Neighbor's House. And joining us from New York studios of NPR, Deputy Ambassador of the United States, former Deputy Ambassador of the United States at the UN Security Council. And Nancy, I should probably point out that was under a Clinton administration. I began to suspect that some of your party credentials were cropping up there when you went through the class photo of the Bush administration throwing darts at the faces. Go ahead.
I think I'll finish the point I was making earlier. I mean, the Bush administration did come to office with a very strong ideological bent of undermining the United Nations, not believing in peacekeeping, not believing in nation building.
Undermining or ignoring?
And they started out very negative on that front, but I have to say that reality has intruded, and they're now doing both peacekeeping and nation building in a way that I think is in our interest. And to their credit, they've been able to do a 180 on these issues when necessary.
But I think, Nancy actually made a series of really good points. I mean, I do think they've been undermining the United Nations. There have been a number of completely surreal moments over the last year, year and a half while I've been doing this. Let's take, for example, the International Criminal Court. Clinton lent his name to the treaty, admittedly in the waning hours of his presidency, and did so with a recommendation that would have to be rewritten before it went to the Senate. But he signed it. The Bush administration then came in and, for the first time in history, tried to unsign a treaty. And it wasn't like, you know, you could pull out the whiteout from your drawer and, you know, put it over the president's signature. They had to file some kind of document saying that they wouldn't stand by the treaty. Well, this horrified its allies in the United Nations. It was a totally surreal moment. And we've seen this time and time again on issues from, you know, the peacekeeping mandate and others, this whole effort to try and get people to sign these Article 98 provisions to the International Criminal Court, which would basically give exemptions for any American overseas from being covered by the court. And just kind of a lot of strong-arm tactics that I think undermine the spirit of the UN, which is this is supposed to be an effort where a place where nations come together and sort out solutions together.
It was actually interesting in the General Assembly speech that the president gave laying out the case for a war with Iraq. He tucked in there one little note call to rejoin UNESCO, which got completely lost in the speech. But you can just imagine sort of scurrying around in the White House saying, we have to do something positive for the UN. And UNESCO was the best they could do. It created a lot of chuckles around the hallway.
Well, also Bush's reference to the League of Nations, of course, did not go unnoticed at all at the UN. And when Kofi Annan had a press conference about a week later and was asked about relations with the White House, he pointedly said, we're nowhere near the League of Nations. I thought that was a very interesting interchange.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Rukia now, who's joining us from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi.
Hi. Thanks. I love your show.
Thanks.
I think what I think is going to happen is that George Bush is going to bribe his way to get his way in this Security Council like he did with China, where he agreed to list the Chinese Muslims as terrorists in order for him to get a favor from the Chinese, where the Chinese Muslims are the most peaceful people in the world. The millions of Chinese people don't deserve to be listed in a terrorist list. And the same thing with Russia. You know, you if you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Okay, so. But that's not bribery, Rukia. That's diplomacy. That's the way that these people make trade-offs and get what they want done.
But then, Ben, that is very wrong. I mean, you list people who are peaceful, list them terrorists to get your way. I think that's very dangerous. It creates a lot of hate, you know, toward us, you know, for some things that we don't approve of. The people simply don't think the Chinese Muslims are terrorists. Millions of them being peaceful. A lot of people don't even know about them.
Right. I'm afraid I don't know specifically what was done there. Maybe Nancy, can I draw on your experience to speak to Rukia's point?
Yeah, I actually agree with her. I mean, there is sort of horse trading that goes on in all of these. And the Bush designation of this small unknown Muslim group in China, I think, did raise a lot of eyebrows. It's not clear exactly what their link to terrorists is. They're certainly a small group there that has on occasion used violent tactics. But I think it's a controversial point there that they would go ahead and anoint this small little sect as a terrorist group, I think did raise some eyebrows. And it was clearly done to try and move the Chinese in our direction. And, you know, unfortunately in foreign policy, you do have to make trade-offs every now and then. And there is, I wouldn't call it bribery, I'd call it horse trading, but she does have a point.
The result can be every bit as ugly, though, is I think.
Yeah, well, you have
saying.
To sort of, everything in life's trade-offs. But the larger point here is one that I think is worth discussing is, you know, is the war on terrorism being broadened to push an agenda here that is not necessarily always in the United States' interest? And I think increasingly as we get into the operation in the Philippines, in Georgia, elsewhere, you know, we may reach a point, and I don't mean to imply we're there yet, but I think at some point we're going to have that debate in the United States of have we taken this a step too far and tried to label everything a terrorist that may or may not have links to terrorism. I don't think we're there yet, but I think there is an important point to keep watching how far we're going in this war on terrorism and make sure that it really is a terrorist regime that we're fighting and not other groups that may or may not have links to terrorism.
Okay, Rukia, thanks for that call to Lowell, Massachusetts now, and Winton's on the line. Hi, Winton.
Hello, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call. All I want to, I have a question. What I want to know is there, does anybody have an idea of how long the Bush administration is willing to give the United Nations a chance for the inspections to work? And if not, another thing that I, a comment I'd like to make is that regardless of what the United Nations does or what anybody else in the world does, it doesn't really matter because Iraq needs to be taken out, and Iraq is going to be taken out anyway. So it doesn't really matter. They might as well just go ahead and do it instead of wasting so much time.
You say they're spinning their wheels at the United Nations. They don't...
Right. It really doesn't make any sense. The United Nations is not going to do anything. It doesn't matter. This war is already going to happen, and it's already going to happen. So what's the point of even dilly-dallying about it? Might as well go ahead and just do it. Everybody already knows.
Elizabeth.
Wow.
That's my comment.
Wow. Well, yes, a lot of us probably have uttered similar speculations as well. But getting back to the United Nations and your first point, should this new resolution pass, part of the tight timetable would be Saddam Hussein has 7 days to say, yes, I am going to comply completely, totally, no fudging. And then he has the remainder of a month to open his presidential palaces to weapons inspectors, to declare all material related to weapons of mass destruction. So that basically is a month. And that's a much shorter timetable than existing resolutions. Now, we should bear in mind that while we're talking about this, you know, in Vienna, we do have the chief UN weapons inspectors meeting with Iraqi officials right now. They're proceeding under the terms of existing resolutions. The Iraqis, we have to remember, did agree to let weapons inspectors return. And under the current timetable, Hans Blix, who's the head of the UN weapons inspection agency, wants to have inspectors back on the ground in Baghdad by October 15th. So either way, as we go through the UN, you know, as we take the UN avenue, we're looking at a pretty tight timetable for things to start happening.
Nancy, what about the waste of time point that Winton is making? Because it's not an uncommonly held view that Bush is just sort of doing a little bit of international tap dance in New York because he feels like he's obliged to do that, but that his gang already has Plan B ready to go.
Well, it's interesting because the administration continuously says the president has not made any decision. There's no war plan on his desk, despite the heated rhetoric from the administration that we're about to launch a war with Iraq. But I don't think he has actually signed off. And when you take an issue to the United Nations, you have a way of getting your foot caught in the door, so to speak. And I think having now come to the United Nations, he may well find that you can't just wake up one day and decide to go to war with Iraq as much as some in the administration would like to do that. I think what's going to happen is they will need to try and exhaust other means of intrusive inspections, more military action on specific sites, and use the regime change as a last resort if necessary. And so it's not just wasting time. You may actually, with this more robust rhetoric on we're really serious about enforcing these UN resolutions, now get further Iraqi compliance so that the threat is not as overwhelming as some make it out to be right now. So this will have a dynamic that is fairly unpredictable on how it unfolds. So I don't think it's a wasted time. It's a messy process. It can be frustrating. It'd be a lot cleaner to just wake up one day and decide we're going to do it. But the reality tends to intrude, and I think it'll have to be a process that plays itself out over the next couple of months.
And in that playing out, Elizabeth, we talked earlier in the program about all necessary means. If that's there, if the language is there, does that mean somebody can go in and use all necessary means, or does it mandate the UN to try and organize some sort of coalition or force? I mean, I don't know whether or not there's any precedent for that? Is it just a nod and a wink to the British and the Americans at this point?
It could go one of two ways. If you remember back in the during the Gulf War, the 1990 Gulf War, I believe and Nancy can correct me because she probably has these memorized to heart, that all necessary means comes from the resolution that was used to put the coalition together to go to war with Iraq if they hadn't withdrawn from Kuwait.
Just jump in here, Nancy, if we're on the right track or the wrong one.
Right. There was one resolution under Chapter 7 mandating all necessary means to ensure the withdrawal of the Iraqi troops from Kuwait. Subsequent resolutions on the disarmament, calling for an end to terrorism, allowing the inspectors in, all refer back to that resolution, and therefore the administration, the U.S. and the U.K. have consistently said we have the right to use force for all those subsequent resolutions because they refer back to that first resolution.
However, there is also the Kosovo example, which was when, in fact, this is the last one of the reasons why there's such fear about a Russian veto is because the Russians threatened to veto a resolution asking for military force against Slobodan Milosevic in Kosovo. Now, the council was pretty united in wanting to move forward. So basically how that worked was a resolution was passed that sort of opened a door to allow the, you know, basically it was handed off to NATO and kind of wink, wink, nod, nod, NATO could move ahead. So I think this could play out a number of different ways. We could see a UN-sponsored coalition, or we could see a kind of we'll hand it off to those countries who want to intervene.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Nancy, I want to go back once more to that informal chamber where all the arm twisting and the shoulder rubbing's taking place, because we were talking earlier in the program about what else is on the table, and a couple of callers brought it up. So if France, for example, or if the Russians are particularly worried about protecting their investments in Iraq, is that the sort of conversation which happens in that chamber, which is then not repeated anywhere in public, that don't worry, go on side with this, we'll make sure that whatever oil contracts you have or money that's owed to you will be taken care of? How far does that go?
Money's never mentioned in that chamber. It's the sort of undercurrent that no one, it's would be considered impolite to raise that in such an august chamber. You end up having sort of much more euphemistic references to it. I mean, I can remember sitting in this chamber, and it's very interesting because you have the Russian delegate, Sergei Lavrov, who's perhaps the most talented diplomat at the UN, who speaks perfect English, always speaks in Russian and insists on the translation. And he can be, on one hand, this kind of suave, you know, westernized New Yorker, and the next minute he's this kind of, you know, Soviet-style tough guy on Iraq. And he would repeatedly argue about the need to lift the sanctions, take care of the humanitarian needs, and criticize the UN in its inspection regime, accuse them of being agents of the United States. But never once would anybody mention that the financial side of this was very much in the background.
Lots to watch. I want to thank you both for coming in. Nancy Soderbergh, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Nancy's former Deputy Ambassador of the United States at the UN Security Council. She's currently Vice President of the International Crisis Group in New York City. And Elizabeth Newford, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth is a reporter for the Boston Globe, author of The Key to My Neighbor's House, soon to be in paperback. Earlier, we spoke with Dominique Moisy, Deputy Director of the French Institute of International Relations. You're welcome to continue this conversation. Go to our forums page. We're at www.theconnection.org. And our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Graham Smith's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
Support for National Public Radio.